720 WGN.
Good evening. Good evening. Karen Conti here. We're celebrating so many things. We're celebrating Easter and Passover and April Fool's Day and the beginning of spring. And what else are we celebrating? Baseball season, although we got off to a little cold start. You know, I love that whole Brian Noonan thing, that April Fool's thing. You know, why do people forget that it's April Fool's Day? They just go right along with it. And I was just thinking about this today. I haven't done an April Fool's Day prank in a while, but I was one of those people who I just, every year, I would start in March, and I would plan who I was going to spoof, and I planned my attack, and I executed it. And I was so proud of myself every year when I would get people. And I just think that, you know, in some ways, some of the things I did probably weren't very nice. Roger, I'm going to weigh in with you. Have you ever really done a prank that really hurt somebody?
No. No.
Okay.
No. I did the usual things around the house. You know, put sugar in the salt shaker.
Yeah,
and
yeah, that's,
pepper
yeah.
in the sugar. And we didn't really celebrate April Fool's. There were things that happened in school. Other kids would do to other kids, but it wasn't, vicious or ill-mannered or anything like that.
So one year, you know what eminent domain is, where you mm-hmm. the government takes over your property and then,
yeah.
and then pays you some money for it. So one year, I had an eminent domain lawsuit drafted up, and I condemned the law school where I went to school at U of I.
Oh, that is so mean.
And I had the property description in there. I had all the details in there. I had it all folded up together, and I had it stamped, and it was as real as it could be. And I had it delivered on April Fool's Day to the dean.
Now, did you deliver it yourself?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was done in Champaign. But I arranged to have it done. I mean,
uh-huh.
you know, I wasn't going to take any chances that with the mail or anything like that. So I actually spent all the time and effort to do that, and it was funny. Because, you know, the academic people are obviously very smart, but they're not, like, really into, like, jokes and mm-hmm. April Fools. And so I had a bunch of people going for a while, apparently. Obviously, they got the drift in about 15 minutes. But it was worth every single minute.
That had to have been.
But the one that stopped me from doing this ever again, I hope my friend's not listening, but
uh-oh.
I had a girlfriend who was getting married. And she was, you know, later in years, so she had waited to get married. And she was so excited. She was having this big old wedding, and she was mm-hmm. bridezilla, you know, the type. And so she had rented out a country club, and she was worried about every detail, and I was hearing all of it. And of course, I'm nodding my head and doing the good friend thing. But so I, of course, called them and had them fax me their letterhead. I put the letter on the letterhead. Dear Ms. Such and Such, your wedding has been canceled due to flooding of the entire banquet facilities, which of course is an act of God, which means you don't get any of your money. Oh, yes.
Oh, that is
I
so
did it.
Mean.
And I faxed it to her. And, oh my gosh. Of course, I followed it up with a call because I wanted to, be in her presence while she was angsting. And I let it go for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I told her that I was the one. But that, she never really recovered that. From that with me.
Yeah.
You know, I think she lost trust with me a little bit.
You think? Seriously? Oh my God, you're lucky she didn't have a heart attack.
I mean, I guess what's funny to somebody is not...
not necessarily,
not
but that's... Isn't that what the gist of April Fool's
yeah.
Day is kind of supposed to be?
I'm a reformed April Fool.
Oh, God bless. See, there's hope for everybody.
And that's, so Easter comes today, so I guess it's all coming around full circle.
There you go.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about this week in legal history, kind of a big week. As many of you know, I go on Facebook and LinkedIn, and I post this day in legal history, and it just seems that every day of the year there is something that happened from a legal perspective. On this day in 1970, President Richard Nixon signed an act which banned cigarette advertisements on radio and television, and it also mandated that the cigarette packaging contain the known warning. The Surgeon General has determined that cigarette smoking is dangerous to your health. And do you remember, I mean, probably a lot of listeners here don't remember, but there used to be advertising everywhere for smoking and alcohol and all those kinds of things. Even in the magazines, you'd see the women smoking their Virginia Slims. And so that was a big deal back in 1970.
The TV shows, not only were there commercials for the cigarettes, but the actors within the program would be smoking incessantly.
Right.
And after that came out, you saw that people didn't smoke anymore in TV shows.
And it would be interesting to know if that really stopped people from smoking. Is something that the government issues that compelling and was advertising really that compelling to get people to stop smoking? Interesting. Interesting. April 2nd, which is tomorrow, in 1992, mob boss John Gotti was found guilty of murder. And he was the Gambino crime family head in New York City. He served much of his federal prison sentence in Marion, Illinois, which many of you know is downstate Illinois. And he died of throat cancer in 2002. And then April 6th, on this day in 1994, the U.S. Supreme Court issued... Justice Blackmun, who issued the opinion, Roe versus Wade, resigned from the court. He was a very interesting and controversial Supreme Court justice. And then on April 4th, on this day, April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. James Earl Ray was convicted of the crime, but in my view, there's some serious doubts about whether he acted by himself or someone else did it. Has anyone been to the Lorraine Motel Civil Rights Museum? Jerry, my husband's raising his hand because I took him there. If you haven't been there, it's a really interesting museum, and it's at the museum. The museum is Lorraine Motel, where King was executed, and across the way, they put up a new exhibit, which is sort of the whole assassination exhibit, and you can actually stand in the room where James Earl Ray supposedly shot King to see if you think that he really could have done what he did. And my opinion, just from having been there and knowing a little bit about the incident, was that it would have been a really, really hard shot. But definitely worth it to go there and to experience it. We have a great show tonight. We're going to be talking about cybersecurity. And listen, I know nothing about that. So this is not a technical discussion. This is a very basic discussion. We had the Cook County sued Facebook this week. Lisa Madigan spearheaded this issue where Facebook gave information to a data analyzing company, either let them have it or gave it to them willingly, which really compromised some privacy. And we're going to talk about that case, use that as a spring board to how can you make sure that what you're doing with your computer is safe? Is your information safe? What kind of password protection should you have? What should you do not to have your identity stolen? Then at 7:30, we're going to be talking to Dr. David Finn, who is a custody expert. We usually really don't use that term anymore in Illinois, but I'll use it for sake of introducing him. And he's going to be talking about a syndrome called parental alienation, which is how parents going through a divorce will badmouth each other to the point where the children are estranged from their parents, a very common syndrome that's very damaging to children. And then we'll be talking a little bit about custody evaluation and how determinations are made as to where children should be living and what kind of time they should spend with their children. And then at the top of the hour, we are going to talk about jury selection. We have the Bill Cosby case is going to be retried coming this week. Monday, tomorrow, is the first day of jury selection in Pennsylvania. And given the whole Me Too advent, what now are we going to do when we select a jury as to issues relating to sexual assault? And we have David Zahner and Paul Zahner, a husband and wife team who do trial consulting and jury selection assistance. And we're going to be talking about what they would do if they were selecting a jury on either side. And then we're going to be taking your calls on any legal topic you might have. I'll give out the numbers now and just hold tight until a little after 8. 312-981-7200, or text to that same number, 981-7200, and I'll give you my number in case you want to talk to me in private. I'm a lawyer. I'm happy to help you and direct you to an answer or a person who can help you. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com or 312-332-7800. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Sued Facebook and Cambridge Analytica for deceptive practices for violating millions of people's privacy. The allegations are that Facebook committed fraud and deceptive practices in mining personal information from Facebook users without their knowledge or consent. And here to talk about the case and what the issues this raises is Juan Carlos Basacoma. the founder and CEO of CIO Landing. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here, Karen.
So, JC, I'm going to call you JC. You've had 30 years of IT experience, and you're affectionately known as the Geek's Geek, and I'm actually looking at your best-selling Amazon book, Sitting Duck, Why Your Business is a Cyber Criminal's Ideal Target. And I'm going to be giving away a copy of that in a little bit. So let's talk about this issue. So Facebook has all this information, and Cambridge Analytica got it. How did this happen, to your knowledge?
So what happened was Cambridge Analytica was given access to a set, or actually a person that worked for them, access to data for research purposes. And this data was downloaded, and through tools that Facebook uses, they were able to query that information and find information about the individual's friends who they were associated. So there were something like 270,000 people, and each person has friends. So they were able to tap into those friends, and that number came up to 50 million.
Wow. So, you know, obviously people are on Facebook. There's all kinds of information. You're going to have your profile information, your age approximately, your education. But what other kinds of information are they mining when you expose Facebook information?
So when you sign typically to Facebook, you're going to be revealing personal information, like whether you're single or married, and if you have children, and where you live, and what race you are, and different types of information that reveal about your personality. Then this information becomes available to folks like Cambridge Analytica, where they know your profile. Now, one of the things that they claim to have done as well is by letting some people use a tool reveal some psychographic information, meaning they'll find out the type of personality that you have. So what they were trying to do was understand more about who the people were. As it turns out, that information didn't pan out as well as they wanted, but they got hold of that data in their servers.
I mean, I talked a little bit about this on the Cochrane Show, we're always having our information mined to some extent. I mean, when we go into the grocery store and we use our card and we get the receipt and it comes back with coupons for things that I've bought in the past, obviously they know my buying history because I've consented to let them do that by having the card. That's part of what they're doing to try to sell me more stuff.
But that's correct.
But we don't think about that when we're on Facebook, that someone is out there getting information that can be used, what, politically? That's, I think, Cambridge Analytica is about politics and trying to understand what my politics are in order to influence me. And that's the part of it that's offensive.
Right. Now, what's interesting is that at the end, the analysis that many folks have done on them is that they were not able to do the type of influencing that they claim to do. In fact, they were portraying this magic they could do, and it turns out they weren't able to deliver on their what they said they were going to do. The thing that's problematic is that they were able to access other people's information without us knowing. So they got hold of that information. And the other piece, I think, from Facebook is they were loose in terms of their restraints about what others can do with the data. And that's something that I think as a young company, they probably didn't think too deep into it.
Sure. And so they're going to all be changing their attitude toward this and changing the whole way they do things, I can imagine. Let's just talk briefly, and we don't have a lot of time, but I want to talk about passwords. I have like 100 passwords, and how should people manage their passwords? Where should they be kept, and what kinds of passwords are passwords we should not use?
So, to your point, one of the most important things in securing your data is to have strong, what they call strong passwords. So we think of a strong password as being a combination of uppercase, lowercase, number, and special character, and it'd be long. And preferably a phrase, so it could be the name of your favorite song. And the idea is that your password should be unique for every single application. Then you say, oh, my gosh, how am I going
to
do that?
How are you going to remember it, right?
How am I going to do that?
There's nothing more frustrating than getting on and you're trying to buy something and you've got PayPal and you have your eBay account and you've got all these passwords and you don't know where they are. And I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well,
I think most people react by doing an easy password.
Exactly. And that is the way hackers get to you. It's an easy password, guessable, and then I can take your account. So one way to do is to use an application that lets you store your password and your username, and there's a master password that controls all of them. It's like a vault, an electronic vault. So that way you can protect all your passwords and allows you to have individual passwords for every application. So
are you telling me, so then you get this application, you figure out a simple password, but that password then is tied to other passwords that you can use for all different venues?
It won't be really a simple password, but it'll be a password you could understand, something that could be the name of your favorite song or something that a phrase that could be, I like to walk Michigan Avenue in a summer day, and
okay,
something you would remember, but it would be very hard to guess. And then from there, the application will create complex passwords that are going to be almost impossible for anyone to guess.
Well, that sounds like something we should all do. Is it safe to buy things online? I think just from a bottom line standpoint, every time I go on to buy something, and now everything, Amazon, whatever, is it safe, or what can we do to be safe other than this password issue that we've already talked about?
Well, it is safe if it's a reputable organization that you're buying from, say an Amazon or a Macy's or one of those, or eBay. Now, there are other questionable websites, and typically you can find out if it is a reputable website by looking at the line where the name of the organization is. On the left side, typically shows a little key, and that key will turn green depending on what kind of computer that you use, or will have some kind of question mark. So it identifies whether it's a safe place to buy from. So you should always pay attention to that.
What should I not open? I see something come up on my screen.
So one of the things you should never open is something that says you have an infection on your computer, call this number. And that happens. Don't ever do that. Or sometimes they'll say, hey, we're scanning your computer for a password. Click here to do an update. And it's something that you've never seen before. That's a telltale sign. Or if you get an email with a link saying, click here to update your password, and you don't know where it's coming from. Very dangerous.
But you usually get updates from your program. So how do you know it's real and how do you know it's not real?
So the one thing you got to make sure is that you have an antivirus that is up to date. You always have to make sure that is current. The other thing you should make sure is that your operating system, whether you're using Windows or a Mac or it's your phone, that you're up to date on updates, because that makes sure that you have the best protection that can be known, that's known at this point in time.
Quickly, this is just a personal curiosity, but these people who put viruses into the community, why do they do it? What benefit do they get?
It's very simple. It's a business. They happen to be on the wrong side of what we like to know as a business. Once they get hold of your information, that can be sold in the dark web. So, for example, a social security number is very valuable because I can sell it. And with that, I can open accounts and I can do nefarious things of that nature.
Can you just tell us briefly what CIO does?
Sure. We are a company that is used by small and mid-sized companies, and we become the outsource IT department. So we help companies solve their technology headaches, and we help them be more productive. The idea is that we remove the technology decision-making from the business owner, so we take on that role.
And it keeps, it just seems to me that that's good for people who are business people who don't want to be dealing with IT. And when you have a problem, you have someone to call, which makes sense. So that sounds like a great business to be in.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I am going to give away a copy of your book, Sitting Duck, Why Your Business is a Cyber Criminal's Ideal Target. Thank you, Juan Carlos Basacoma, for coming in.
Thank you, Karen.
Good
to see you.
Having
me here.
All right. We're going to take a break. You're listening to WGN. holiday, and there's some parents who are not seeing their children, and it's sad. Most parents who divorce and live apart naturally want to have a good, close, loving relationship with their children. But in some cases, a child will reject a parent and resist contact, even going so far as to be afraid of being with that parent. And this is called parental alienation. Joining us to talk about this devastating psychological condition is Dr. David Finn. David, welcome to the show.
Great, thank you.
Dr. David Finn has his doctorate in psychology. He's the owner of Associates in Human Development Counseling. He's a court-appointed evaluator in many in Chicago and many courts in the collar counties. He has clinical expertise in child custody, parental alienation, high-conflict families, and co-parenting. Let's talk about this idea. What does it look like when a child has been alienated by a parent?
Well, Karen, thanks for asking. The alienated child generally is one who rejects contact with that parent with whom they've been alienated. Their rejection often reaches kind of a fervor to the point where it seems like a campaign against that parent. And the rejection extends to other family members, grandparents and other relatives with whom that child has previously had a good relationship with.
So this is not just dad is being a jerk and I hate my dad and I'm not going to see him or his entire family. This is something more than just a parent's bad conduct that provokes a child to reject him.
Yeah, this is an overarching theme that the child develops.
Okay. And does it occur only when there are divorces, or can it occur in an intact family?
You know, I suppose it could occur in an intact family. However, for the most part, it comes to light in the context of a divorce.
Okay. And what motivation would a parent have to badmouth another parent?
Well, oftentimes the hurt and the pain that parent has gone through, just in going through the loss of that relationship, can be a motivating factor to that parent to badmouth the other parent to the children.
I guess a typical example that I see in my practice, doctor, and it's totally gender neutral, right? We got right.
Correct.
It could be men who are alienating children from their mom and vice versa. But here, an example would be, let's just say the dad cheated on the wife, and so now they're getting a divorce, and now mom is really mad and found out all about the cheating over a number of years, and now she's got the kids, and she's telling them stuff about the divorce, and maybe she's saying, you know, dad's a bad guy, you know, and maybe you shouldn't go on visitation, or maybe she doesn't even really need to say those words. Maybe it's just her attitude and her concern and her animosity that sort of rubbing off on the kids.
Right. So parents often confuse they fail to realize that their ex-spouse is not their child's ex-spouse. And they fail to recognize that there's a important distinction between being a spouse or an ex-spouse and being a parent. And what they fail to do is to promote and to really understand the importance of promoting that relationship between the children and the other parent.
And you are a doctor in this area, and I have done a little bit of reading compared to what you've done. But my reading tells me that one of the most important things you can do is just that, to really actively promote your children's good relationship with the other parent, even if you don't like that person, even if you don't approve of that person, as long as they're not hurting the children, right? They're not harming the children in any way. That's a whole different thing. But it's important, isn't it?
Right. That can be the most important thing to do, but also the most difficult thing to do for parents who are going through or have just gone through a divorce.
So let's just say that there are some parents out there, or they know their children or they know friends, where the children are not seeing them and there's no relationship and they can't get communication. What is it that they should be doing to try to rectify the situation?
Well, a parent who believes that they have been alienated should, first of all, contact an attorney who is skilled and understands parental alienation. And that parent should be seeking some direction from the court to facilitate their ability to resume their contact with their child.
I see all the time, and there's some really good judges out there, and as you know, doctor, but there's some that don't understand alienation. And what they'll see is they'll see a child, perhaps a teenager who's 13 years old, saying, I don't want to see mom. I don't like mom. I don't want to see mom. I don't want to see mom's family. And the judge kind of says, well, that's really unnatural because most kids want to be with both parents. They really do. So mom must have done something wrong. Maybe she needs counseling. Maybe she needs to be examined because she's doing something that is making the child act this way. And I see judges miss that all the time. And do you see that?
Right. So the judges who I know are all good, caring people, and I'm sure you would agree.
I do.
Judges who want to do well by the families and the children whose lives are in front of them. But there's oftentimes a lot of misunderstanding around this whole idea of parental alienation or children who are expressing wishes against being with one parent or the other.
If you have any comments or questions for Dr. David Finn, give us a call here, 312-981-7200. If you've had a situation where maybe you've been alienated from your children, I'd like to hear about it. Someone in the texting line said that the non-custodial parent can also alienate the children. I've seen it. Meaning, the parent who doesn't... the non-custodial parent can alienate. So let's just say the children are with mom and go with dad every other weekend in some sort of standard parenting time. Do you see that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Either parent is capable, if they wanted to discourage that relationship between the child and the other parent.
Do you see this play out in court where judges will recognize the syndrome and basically say, if you're not going to encourage a relationship, parent, you're not going to see your kids. Do you see judges do that?
There are some judges who do take that tough line.
When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what it is that you can do to break this alienation. And I sort of think it's akin to brainwashing in a way, right?
It is.
Because the kid, you know, the kids grow up loving both their parents, no matter what. I mean, even if parents aren't perfect, you know, you see children, they love their parents. They want to be with mom and dad separately and mostly together, but apart. And so when you see them not wanting to be with the parent, it's just a really unnatural situation.
Absolutely. Children are hardwired to love both of their parents.
Right.
Children get spanked and love that parent who spanks them. Children get yelled at and love that parent who yells at them. Children love parents who they visit in jail. So it is completely unnatural for a child who, without any substantial reason, and a child who had a good enough relationship to begin with, for that child to reject a parent.
Give us a call here if you have a comment, 312-981-7200. We're talking to Dr. David Finn about parental alienation and child custody issues on the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. David Finn about parental alienation. It's a syndrome where parents brainwash their children to disassociate with the other parent. So I want to finish up this topic. Doctor, what is it that you do when you see a situation? Let's just say that it's a little boy, he's alienated from his mother because dad was saying bad things about mom. What is it that you do in therapy to try to undo what's been done?
So you bring up an interesting point, because younger children generally are less susceptible to the alienation than older children. So with younger children, we look at, and certainly when I evaluate a case, I look at whether or not that child is likely to become alienated if the parents' behaviors do not change. The older children are generally the ones who are alienated and refusing contact, and those children are generally more difficult cases to work with. In therapy, there's a lot of really terrific programs out there. There's Richard Warshak, who's involved with Family Bridges program. There's Overcoming Barriers, which is another program for working with alienation. We also have a program in my practice, which is called Family Ties, which is a 16-week intensive therapy program for families dealing with estrangement and alienation.
And without going into the details, is it fair to say that what you try to do is you try to take the child away from that alienating parent so that you can kind of extricate him or her from that toxic environment?
You know, I like to think of it as removing those alienating influences, not necessarily the parent, but if the parent, if we could work with the parents to understand what they're doing and the effect that that's having on the child, we can hopefully help that child to maintain healthy relationships then with both of their parents.
I got a text from the 815 area code. I would have to disagree to a point. Many teenagers don't like or want to be with their parents in the best of circumstances. She says that she is from has a blended family, and when one of the girls was a teen, she found every excuse not to come on the weekends. We all got along, and everyone was treated fairly. What do you have to say about that?
Well, you know, children sometimes don't like a parent, but I think it's important for parents that they don't give their child a choice in the matter. They don't give their child a vote, that the child is expected to spend the time that they need to spend with the other parent.
Well, that's true, and I tell my clients this. You know, if your child doesn't want to take vitamins or get the flu shot or whatever it is, you don't say, okay, I'm not going to have you do that because you don't want to do it. Same as if you want to go see your, you don't want to go see your dad, you tell your child you're going to have to see your dad because your dad's a good guy and you have to have a relationship with him, and I want you to have a good weekend. Enjoy yourself, right?
Absolutely.
You got to tell your kid what to do. That's part of being a parent.
Absolutely. I mean, parents have to encourage their children and reassure their children that both parents love them and that it's not their fault.
Even if you harbor all kinds of resentments.
Well, and that's about separating the parents' needs from the child's needs.
Absolutely. You talked a little bit about a presentation that you're going to be giving in the future about domestic violence and custody litigation and litigation involving children. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's very interesting.
This is a presentation on the ways that people can use the court system to exercise control over the other parents.
And how does that work generally? What's the typical case that you're talking about?
You know, the typical case might be one that is perpetuated for months or years with multiple pleadings and court filings or actions intended to limit the other parent's access to the children, to take the children away from the other parent. Oftentimes we see this in the context of coercive controlling domestic violence.
Interesting, where you have maybe a party coming in and bringing motion after motion just to bring the other parent back into court to be reckoned with.
Correct.
I do see that quite a bit, and it's devastating because you have to go to court. There's no option when someone files a motion, and a lot of times the people responding have to hire lawyers, and lawyers are exceptionally expensive, and the process is devastating to the whole entire family, not to mention causing stress for the children.
Absolutely.
You do custody evaluation. We don't use that word in Illinois anymore. We use it parenting time and allocation of decisions. Those are nicer words than custody. But when you get appointed by a court to do an evaluation, you say, Dad wants 50% parenting time. Mom says, no, Dad should only have it every other weekend. Mom says, I should be doing all the scheduling of medical appointments. And Dad says, no, I want to be making those decisions with you. What do you do in your evaluation to give the judge the information that you think he needs to make the decision?
Well, the information the judge needs, it really comes out of a very thorough evaluation of both parents. In my practice, I meet with parents usually 10 hours or more with each parent. I meet with the parents and the children together. I also interview the children. And in addition, there's psychological testing for the parents. There's contact with other collateral sources and also review of the voluminous collateral materials that parents want us to review to help to support their concerns.
I think a lot of people are interested in how much weight do you give to a child who says, I want to be with Mom and I don't want to be with Dad, or I want to spend time with both, 50-50. How much weight do you give, and at what age does a child's preferences, let's say, come into play?
Well, first of all, a child never gets to decide. And the weight that a child's narrative, the weight that I give to a child's narrative is really based on the rationale and the reasons behind the position that the child has taken.
Do you also weigh in the fact that maybe one of the parents has tried to talk to the child to try to get the child to say something positive to go in the way of that parent?
I think it's important for every evaluator to, at the very least, be curious and to be skeptical as to the influences that may be at play.
I want to get back to the custody decisions in a minute, but I've got a caller who wants to talk a little bit about alienation. Paul, welcome to the show. You've been alienated from your child?
Well, it was a case of my first wife tried alienating our four kids, and there was a thing there where the distance between where I lived and where she moved to was about 500 miles. So I didn't get to see the kids very often. And when my oldest one turned 14. Now, this is back in the days when the kids could make the decision at the ripe old age of 14. She walked uptown and got herself an attorney and went over to the county courthouse and got a change of custody.
So, I'm sorry, she came to live with you?
Yes.
Okay. And how did that end up working out?
It worked out quite well.
And I just want to see if there's a happy ending here. Does your daughter have a good relationship with both you and your ex-wife?
Well, my ex-wife is no longer around.
Okay.
She's met her maker in...
Okay.
That's
good. Thank you for sharing your story, Paul. That's another thing that's changed in the law, that parents are really not allowed to move that far away, or if they are, there's going to be circumstances that need to be dealt with if parents are moving that far away, because that makes it very difficult.
It certainly can.
Yeah. So let's go back to the issue of parenting time. And so many parents have it in their head that they want 50-50 parenting time. That's fair. That's what fair is. Fair is 50-50. And, in fact, I think about a couple weeks ago, there was a bill that was introduced in the Illinois legislature that was basically the default mode would be 50-50 parenting time. It wasn't passed. I don't know if it will be passed. But what do you think about this 50-50?
Well, I think it's important for parents to maintain good contact with their children. I think it's important for parents to have equitable contact, but not necessarily even contact. There are no two families that are the same. To presume that 50-50 is best would be to presume that a 14-year-old's needs are the same as a 2-year-old's needs. It would be to presume that parents who live 10 miles away from each other are the same as parents who live 10 blocks away from each other. So I think there are a number of different factors that need to be considered when coming up with a good parenting time plan that is unique for each individual family.
I have clients who, and I understand that they have angst and they don't want to be away from their children, but they literally will calculate the hours and the minutes that the children are with them and with the ex-spouse. And I try to explain to them that what you want is quality time. So maybe an overnight is not quality time because they're just basically going home to sleep, whereas some extended time on a Sunday might be really great time because there's no homework, there's a day where you can spend with your kids and really connect with them. And so that, what, like you're saying, we should be looking at the quality of that time as opposed to the number of minutes.
Yeah, I think it's important for parents to make it their business to be a part of their child's life. And that doesn't just occur on a parenting time plan, but that occurs when that parent is able to go to the child's school, to participate in school activities, to show up to extracurricular activities, to wave to their child from the benches. These are all important capacities of parents who want to be part of their children's lives.
Can children survive a divorce? I think so many parents hesitate to get a divorce because they are so concerned at the devastating effects on children. What do you think? Can children survive this?
Well, children can and do survive divorce. I mean, it is certainly an important and a critical change in their lives, and children are affected by divorce. But children are also affected by living in a home with one or two unhealthy parents who are married to each other.
And watching your children fight is not a good thing to grow up with.
Watching your parents fight, absolutely.
Yeah, sorry, that's what I meant. And, you know, it's interesting that I know there's some studies done, and you probably see studies all over the place on this, but I read a really interesting study that said that, you know, in these high-conflict divorces, those are the ones where that conflict lasts. That's when it really affects the children adversely. But if it's just a divorce and parents can get on and they can then go to the extracurricular activities together and they can share custody and they can alternate holidays and they can get along and buy each other Mother's Day and Father's Day gifts, that children can cope with that, and it's not as devastating as we may have thought earlier.
Hey, absolutely. Children are not as invested as in the address at which their parents' mail arrives as they are in being able to maintain a good relationship with both of their parents.
And that should be the goal for everyone. And for everyone out there, even if you don't like your ex, say some nice things about him or her today. Wouldn't that be a good thing to do?
Absolutely.
Doctor, where can people reach you if they want your help?
They could reach me at my practice, the Associates in Human Development Counseling in Palatine, Illinois. Phone number is 847-483-0800. And my website is www.ahdcllc.com.
And if you didn't get all of that information, I think we're going to post it on the website. And you can always call me at the office or email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. And I'm happy to give you contact information for Dr. David Finn. Thank you so much for joining us, and happy holidays to you.
Great. Thank you, Cindy.
All right. You're listening to WGN. We'll be back in a minute. Cosby case, nearly 1 year after jurors failed to reach a verdict on the sexual assault charges against Bill Cosby, and he's now being ready to be tried again. And this time, the attorneys will be factoring in the Me Too movement. And here to talk about the jury selection, which is starting on Monday, are the resident jury selection experts, David and Laura Zahner. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Karen.
Good to see you guys. Thank you, and happy Easter. I want to talk, first of all, Zahner Trial Consulting, your trial consulting firm. You've assisted attorneys in almost all 50 states doing mock trials, focus groups, and jury selection services. Laura, you're an attorney. David, you're a PhD, and together you help select jurors all over the country. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the case. We have a woman named Andrea Constan, and it was about 14 years ago, and she claims that she went over to his house and he gave her some sort of drug and sexually assaulted her. The jury was hung and a mistrial was declared. What is the difference now with the trial? What is going to happen that's different than it was last time?
Well, what the prosecution is going to do is they've talked to all the jurors from the previous case, and they know what went wrong with their previous case. The jurors have been very good about not speaking to the media, so we have a very limited amount of information about exactly why they were unable to reach a verdict. But the prosecution definitely knows, and what generally happens in cases I've had where our clients have been retried, and we've been working for defendants, we have found that the prosecution does a very good job of slimming their case down and really focusing on just the very strongest points they have. And in the Bill Cosby case, what they are focusing on now is getting in the 19 other women who have made similar allegations. In the original trial, they were only allowed to bring in one witness to collaborate. And what the jurors told them is the lack of pattern evidence made it very difficult for people to believe that this actually happened. And that was one thing they were holding out on.
And we know that there are probably 60 women or so who basically said the same thing happened to them over a course of years. But of course, all of those people don't get brought into trial. How do you factor in that maybe some of these potential jurors not only know about those 60 women who made claims, but know about what happened with the mistrial?
Well, excuse me. Jurors generally take the evidence and examine it in detail, and I think the jurors did that in this case as well. What they struggled with were definitions. That's what they sent back to the judge numerous times, were questions about definitions related to various legal terms. One of them was unconscious. And I think that's a big question for a lot of women is, it's a question that everyone asks themselves is, what is consent? And can an unconscious person consent? And how unconscious does a person have to be? In this case, she was able to respond to certain questions, and she was able to talk, and she did say that in her deposition. So I think that was the thing that many of the jurors struggled with, is the definition of unconsciousness. So I think the prosecution is going to have to really parse that out in the new trial and make sure they understand that unconscious is a legal term as well as a term that jurors know in the mainstream, you know, vernacular.
Yeah, and then there's going to be extensive questioning for all these jurors about what they know about the previous case and what they've heard in the media. It's going to be very difficult to pick a jury. They're going to spend days and days, just like they did last time, and probably go through several hundred jurors to get the 18 people who will actually be on the jury.
There's evidence, we know that Bill Cosby paid her some money in a civil settlement. We don't know how much. I saw lately some number of 3.6 million has arisen. I don't know if that's true or not, or if that's just fake news. But in any event, how important is that? Which way does that cut? Now, on one hand, if Bill Cosby paid, let's say he paid $3 million to settle her case, wow, that doesn't sound like an innocent person, right? Maybe the average person goes, why would you pay $3 million if you didn't do anything? On the other hand, is she just out for money? And is he a wealthy guy? And he just wanted to put this to bed, literally. And so which way does it cut?
Yeah, this is what we call eye of the beholder evidence, where the people whose pre-existing attitudes and beliefs are to think that Bill Cosby is innocent say, oh, she's just out for money. She took all that money, and now they're having a criminal case. Whereas the people who think that he is more likely guilty or think that if a woman makes these kinds of allegations, they must be true, they see that as a sign of guilt that he made the payment. In general, it's a bad fact. It's very hard for even the strong defense jurors to say, yeah, he wouldn't have paid $3.6 million for nothing, although what he said in the first trial was he mainly just wanted to keep it away from his wife, which is understandable to many jurors.
Right, right. So let's talk about the Me Too revolution, where all these women have come out in all different professions, including the entertainment world, saying, yes, it happened to me. How is this going to affect now? And Gloria Allred came out and said, oh, this is going to make conviction a lot easier because now women are more free to say that this happened to them. Laura, what do you think? Is this true? Is this going to make conviction easier?
I think that's just a simple answer of a fairly complex issue. In some cases, it's going to make it easier, I think. But in other cases, it's going to make it harder because I think people are going to look at the evidence a lot harder, and they're going to be harder on people who they perceive as going against the Me Too movement. I do think over the years it will change, but I don't know that it's going to change tomorrow or the next day. We've seen it a few times already where people say, I think she's just doing this, you know, tip for the publicity or because this is something that's been out there in the media and they're taking advantage of it. So I think that down the line it might slowly change, especially as some of these younger people come up through, you know, become jurors. But I don't necessarily think that's going to be the groundswell everyone thinks it is.
And David, you've had some recent experience with your firm in this kind of case.
Yes, Laura and I picked a jury for a workplace sexual harassment case in a federal court in Chicago. And what we found, surprisingly, in fact, the judge was amazed that we were going to let this case go to trial. She said, well, how are you going to even try this in this kind of environment? And what happened is we had many women, potential jurors, say that they had been victims of this type of harassment and that therefore they would not be able to fairly judge. And what happened there is that instead of us having to use a strike to exclude people we knew were going to be bad for us, the judge ended up eliminating them for cause. And the jurors who were left ended up being jurors who were skeptical of these kind of claims.
Wow.
And it ended up being a very quick defense verdict for us.
So just to phrase that again, you have people saying, I am so mad that I was harassed, I could not be fair to this defendant. So now they're off the jury, and now we have people who may not be as willing to believe it because they're not people who maybe have had it happen to
them.
Yes,
and this would be especially true of the women. I mean, by the time they get to actually picking the jurors for the Bill Cosby case, they are going to have eliminated all the women who feel that they've been a victim of this type of activity. And they're also going to have eliminated all the women who just think that if a woman makes a claim, it must be true. The women who are going to be left are the women who are going to focus on the actions of the accuser. And they are going to focus on the actions that she did not act like a victim. She did not report it right away. She did many things that they would say, I would not have done that. I would have handled this differently if this happened to me. And so surprisingly, women may actually be the best jurors for Bill Cosby in this case.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about your firm and how people can contact you?
Zahner Trial Consulting. You can catch us on the web, www.zahner, Z-E-H-N-E-R, juries.com. And we would love to hear from what anyone is interested in finding out from us.
You guys do great work. Thank you so much for joining us on this Easter Sunday. Take care. You're listening to WGN, The Karen Conti Show. Now is the time I take legal questions of all types. I've been a practicing lawyer for 30 years, and I've run into many, many questions over my career, and hopefully I'll be able to either answer your question or send you in the right direction. I'm going to give out the numbers here, 312 312- 1-800-981-7200. You're going to tell me what your issue is, what your problem is, as quickly as you can, and I'm going to try to give you some guidance. If for some reason you want to contact me confidentially, you can always give me a call at my office at any time of the day or night, 312-332-7800. That's a confidential line. Or better yet, give me your facts, give me your county, give me when it happened and what you're looking for in an email. WGN@AskKarenConti.com. WGN@AskKarenConti.com. And while we're waiting for the phone lines to fill up, I'm going to give away the book from Juan Carlos Bosacoma, which is Sitting Duck, Why Your Business is a Cyber Criminal's Ideal Target. And I'm going to also give out his contact information. He is with CIO. He can help with your cyber protection and your IT services. And his number is 847-868-9253. CIO is the name of the company. And if you want that contact information, you can always call me at my office to get that. So give us a call here. I'm going to go to my little archive of questions that I got this past week. I had a woman from Facebook, a very nice woman who I'm in contact with, who has said this might be a question for your show. What is your opinion on forming a business partnership between two unrelated people? Are you for or against it? She said, I had a retail company for 12 years with my ex-husband, so I know how to run a company, but I have this female friend from church, and we want to start an upscale hair salon in the immediate community. And one of them has business experience, one of them has the hair experience, and she wanted to know what my best thoughts were on forming a company. Well, that's really a good thing that you're thinking about this, because no matter what kind of company you have, no matter what kind of business relationship you have, whether it's a very close relationship or whether it's somebody you don't know at all, you have to have it all in writing. It is crucial. And I always say to people, the more that you know someone, the closer you are to that person, the more you need a business contract, a business formation, because you don't want to assume things. You don't want to ruin friendships, and you don't want to presume that certain people are going to act certain ways. And you need to have a meeting of the minds. And one of the beauties of having a business plan and having a contract that binds you is you're talking about those things before it happens. So you're talking about who's going to take the finances here, who's going to do the books and records, what contribution are you going to put in, what hours are you going to work, how are you going to get customers, who's going to pay for these initial things, who's going to make decisions based upon their experience, who's going to put in the hair dryers, who's going to create the website. So all of these things have to be spelled out, and it's important that they're spelled out in detail. And it's important to get a good lawyer to put together that contract that spells out those particulars. As far as whether it's going to be a partnership or a corporation or an LLC, that's certainly something that you would consult with a lawyer about, and the lawyer would tell you the pros and the cons of all of those things to protect you. And again, going into business without a formation of a company is really, really a bad idea, because then every liability that the business has could be yours, meaning all of your assets and your kids' college accounts could possibly be at risk. But there are certainly ways to create a business and keep and maintain your books and records in a way that protects you and your loved ones from any liability. And let's face it, there are people out there who sue all the time, and you want to protect yourselves from those things. Let us go to Jane. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Thank you for calling. What is your legal problem? Oh, she dropped. Jane, I think she had a neighborhood dispute, which is a very, very, very common question. Let me go to my archives here. Let's see. Oh, I saw your Facebook video about the new law regarding where pets go in a divorce. How do these issues get decided? And if you're Facebook friends with me, we put together a little video about when the marriage goes to the dogs, where do the dogs go? And there's a new law, and it basically spells out what a judge must consider in deciding where a pet might go to live. Basically, it says that if it's a gift to one party, then that belongs to that party. If it's a family dog, a family animal that has been shared by the parties, the judge is allowed to look into the welfare of the animal. And Steve Dale is going to love this, of course. He's already loving this, which means that where is that dog best suited? If you've got a stay-at-home parent, maybe that dog is best with the stay-at-home parent who's not traveling and needs to have the dog in doggy daycare. The other things that are considered that I've seen is where do the children live most of the time? And if the children are very attached to an animal, the courts will maybe say the dog should be where the kids are. I have a case that is a 50-50 parenting time where the kids are going back and forth, and the dog goes back and forth with the kids. The kids get dropped off, and the dog gets dropped off. And so that works out for them. I'm not sure I'd advocate that situation for everybody. But in any event, the law is good because it does take into account the animal's welfare as well as the children's best interest and the owner's best interest. So always a good law that considers those things. Let me give out the numbers again. Our phone lines are wide open, so give us a call. 312-981-7200. And let's also open it up if you have any questions about any topics that you've seen in the news, whether it's the Cosby trial or we talked about child custody or some of those issues. Give us a call here. This came from a caller in the 847 area code. She called and said, I am the owner of a small business and I just received a legal document called a citation. It's regarding an employee of mine. What do I need to do and do I need a lawyer? And I've answered these questions before. Sometimes you get these things in the mail. Well, the first thing you do when you get a legal document in the mail is do not ignore it because a legal document is binding. You have to make sure it's real because sometimes people will send things that look legal, but they're really not. So you're going to make sure it's real. You're going to maybe look it up online. You're going to Google what a citation is. You're going to see what it's about. And a citation can be a bunch of things. But what I'm guessing from this call was that a citation was issued. Let's say an employee owes money to somebody and there's a judgment against the employee for $100,000. The citation is asking the employer, are you holding any money for that employee? Is that employee owed wages? How much in wages did that employee make? And maybe there's going to be a garnishment of wages. So you as an employer, you don't have a choice. You have to produce the documents that are called for, and if the citation says that you have to go to court and appear and bring certain documents, then you must do that. Now, do you need a lawyer? You really don't need a lawyer. If you feel more comfortable having a lawyer, you certainly can call a lawyer, but of course, they're going to charge you. Sometimes you may not understand exactly what the citation is looking for. So what you're going to want to do is look up the lawyer who issued it. You'll find that lawyer's name right on the document, and you'll have his or her contact information. So you call up the person, you say, I received this. Maybe I can't get the documents together in time. Maybe I can't appear in court on that particular day. Can you change the day so I can appear in court and work out something with the lawyer? Because the lawyer wants the information. The lawyer is not trying to punish you. The lawyer is not trying to hurt you. The lawyer just wants compliance with what is being asked. So let's we're going to take a break here, and I'm going to give out the numbers again. Please give us a call. The phone lines are wide open, or text us, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law. Well, you see,
welcome back.
I didn't really
Karen Conti here on a cold Easter weekend. You know, I think of Easter and I have these great memories of going out and flying kites and riding my bicycle and being sick on eating too much chocolate. And it just doesn't seem like an Easter Sunday. It seems like it seems just too cold to be true. But hopefully we'll be turning around soon and seeing the tulips. You have time here to call in. The phone lines are filling up, but we're going to try to get to everyone tonight. Legal questions of any type or comments on anything you've heard on the show, I'm happy to talk to you tonight. 312-981-7200. Let's go. This is Lester. Hi, Lester. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hey there. How are you, young lady?
Thank you. I'm so young. That was not funny. Okay.
Oh, gosh. No, I had some questions regarding a divorce situation. I have a child, about 8 years old, and the next wife. The issue is a lot of assets that I had the marriage were taken away, and those are assets that I use for income, some rental properties and things of that nature. The assets were taken away and given to the wife in her name. I, unfortunately, in the time of the marriage, placed a lot of the assets in the wife's name because I did not want to be sued and have those assets taken away from me. But the judge gave her the assets, and currently she's doing a number of jobs, and she has me to take care of the child, and I have not paid child support from the date of the marriage or the divorce, and trying to find out if it makes sense to try to take this back to court or just to continue on, let the actual amounts come up for the payment for the actual settlement for child care, and just to generate dollars. Unfortunately, I have long scales of time before dollars come to me, so
Lester,
it makes it very difficult.
Let me ask you just a simple question, and then I'll give you my best answer. Do you have an order in place that says that you, Lester, have to pay child support an X amount of dollars?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about a couple things, if you don't mind. Can I put you on hold, Lester?
No problem.
Okay, great. I'm going to address a few things that you said. One of the things that, this is just for everybody, anything that's acquired during the marriage, acquired meaning you buy it, you get it during the marriage, belongs to both parties no matter whose name it's in. So let's just say that I buy a bicycle and it's in my name, or I buy a car, it's in my name. During the marriage, it belongs half to me and half to Jerry, even though it's just in my name, okay? So let's just say that I inherited money during the marriage. My aunt Mildred gave me $100,000. If I take that money and I put it into the house that I own with my husband, or let's say I put it into a joint account, it is presumed that I'm gifting that money to the marriage. Okay, so it's not mine anymore, it's the marriage's. But if I keep it separate, and I that inheritance money I keep separate, I can keep that as mine if I were to get divorced. So when Lester said he had these properties and they were given to his wife, the question would be, you know, they were probably acquired during the marriage, and even though he put the properties in his wife's name, you know, they probably were hers jointly from the beginning, unless he gifted them to the marriage by putting them in her name. But so those are things that when you are married and you are getting married, you should really have a very clear understanding of what belongs to you and what belongs to the marriage, because let's be real, you will probably face divorce. Not probably, but, you know, 50%, and some stats will say it's even more than 50%. So protect yourself, make sure you know what you owe, and make sure you know what you have, make sure you know what you're giving away if you're changing title in certain pieces of property. The second thing that I want to talk about is child support. It sounds like she's making more money than him. And it sounds like he's taking care of the child a little bit more than was contemplated. You never, ever violate a child support order. Even though he had a child support order, he's saying, I'm not going to pay it because things have changed and she's making money and I'm taking care of the child. But that keeps accruing. And in certain circumstances, the government could continue to think that you owe that money, and they could take away your driver's license or take away privileges or glom on to your tax refund if they think that you're not paying and that there's been no change in court order. Just because you have an agreement with your spouse doesn't mean that you don't have to pay court-ordered support. And even if she agrees, maybe at some point she might disagree and say, oh no, I never agreed, and now you owe me $100,000. And there's huge interest on child support. There's huge interest that accrues every day that you don't pay it. So what, Lester, you need to do is you need to go back into court and you need to vacate the child support order, or to modify it in a way that makes sense. And maybe you're even entitled to support from her. Not that you want to stir that nest, but you might want to do that. And there's a new child support statute very recently that considers both parties' income in deciding what child support is. So if you want to give me a call at the office, I can maybe take a quick look at what the numbers are, and I can give you a quick estimate of what I think your reduction might be or what child support might be in your circumstance. And you can call me at 312-332-7800 or WGN at AskKarenConti.com. We have phone lines still open. Give us a call here, 312-981-7200. Let me go to a call from last week. This was the week before. I was in a car accident. The other driver got a ticket. I've been waiting for the other driver's insurance company to settle with me. It's been over a year. Do I need to hire a lawyer? Doesn't the insurance company owe it to me to settle with me? And how much should I be asking to settle? I get these questions all the time, very similar questions. And what happens is if, you know, generally speaking, if you have a fender bender and you have a few hundred dollars worth of damages, maybe it's not worth it to get a lawyer. But if you have any injury at all that has any long-lasting effect or that you had some hospital bills, you are entitled to recover. You're entitled to be compensated for your pain and suffering, for your medical bills, for any permanent loss, for any loss of wages that you incurred because you couldn't go to work due to the accident. And you do need a lawyer for that. A lot of times these insurance companies don't settle with you. They wait and they string you on and they ask you questions and then they don't settle. And then 2 years goes by and guess what? There's a 2-year statute of limitations that runs 2 years from the date of the accident. And they're banking on the idea that you might not settle and then you're not going to be able to bring the lawsuit. So if you know that the insurance company is not being fair with you, I would say get a lawyer right away. And the question about how much do you settle for? How much is an injury worth? That's something that only a good personal injury lawyer could tell you. And even though I've been practicing for 30 years, I don't do this kind of work. So I couldn't really even give you a great estimate on what you're entitled to. I can give you a ballpark, but a good personal injury lawyer will know what the going rate is for a certain kind of injury, and it depends upon the county where this happened, and it depends on a number of things. So if you don't know a lawyer who does personal injury cases, I wouldn't just go in the phone book or whatever you use these days by Googling or finding someone on a park bench. That's not the way to do it. Call somebody you know or call me, and I'll refer you to somebody who can handle your case. Who I know, you know, maybe they handled a case like this in Lake County. Maybe they handled a broken arm at Walmart, you know, that they slip and fall. And I know that the lawyer is going to be good for your case and going to get you, you know, something that's fair and reasonable for what happened to you.
I got a question.
Sure.
Cash. So I was in a car accident about a month ago. Ooh. Where a driver backed into my driver's side.
Okay.
And his insurance company is not trustworthy whatsoever.
Yep.
And they're refusing to pay for all the damages. They told me that I must go to one of their shops that I don't trust. So I was forced, now I'm being forced to go through my insurance company and pay my deductible. What are the chances that my insurance company can go after his company to get everything reimbursed back to me and them as well for what they have to pay out to get the car fixed?
They probably will do that. It's called subrogation. And
okay.
That means that when you get insurance and there's somebody else who's responsible, your own insurance company will pay it, but then they'll go after the wrongdoer for that amount. And they should also go after the wrongdoer for the deductible as well. Since they're going after them for what they've paid, might as well go after them for the deductible. Have you spoken to them about whether or not they're going to pursue the wrongdoer?
They're saying that they're going to go after them, but the only worry is whether or not they're going to accept fault with the accident.
Okay.
So that's the only concern. I mean, we all have copies of the police report, and you know, the driver himself said, the driver himself said, you know, that he was at fault. But we've read reviews online of the insurance company that he has, and other people have been in the same predicament saying that they don't always get their money reimbursed back to them. So I was just curious as to what I could do in case something goes wrong.
Yeah, how much is it all together? All of the property damage?
$3,100.
Okay, and what your deductible is what?
$500.
Okay. So, you know, that's a lot of money. And if your insurance company doesn't go after them, you could bring a lawsuit yourself in small claims court and bring a suit against them. The issue is the insured, you know, the person who hit you probably wants their insurance company to cover it.
Right.
They don't want to be sued because if you sue them, they're going to have to pay it,
right?
Unless they get their insurer to cover it. And that's one of the things that I would do is I'd say to the person, listen, I'm going to have to sue you. So why don't you get on the phone and tell that substandard insurance carrier to do what they contracted to do, which is to pay the damages on clear fault. And tell them to do that. And maybe by putting pressure on the insured, that insured is going to be able to put pressure on the insurance company to do what's right.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. We still have time left for some calls. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. This is your last opportunity to get some legal calls in. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Let's go. I have a texter who said, I broke my leg last week at home and have a cast and crutches. My job requires me to perform physical labor. I already had taken my 2 weeks vacation. Does my employer now have to allow me time off or light duty while I recover? Now, I'll bet if we polled people out there, they'd say, well, of course the employer has to give you time to recover. But if we go back and look at this, we have to look at it from a legal standpoint. She broke her leg at home last week, so that means it didn't happen on the workplace. So that means it's not a work injury, so it's not workers' compensation. Okay, that would be different because if you are hurt on the job, then there are certain rights that you get because you were hurt on the job, which is laws in place to encourage employers to make sure your workplace is safe. But that doesn't apply because she did it at home. She already took her time off. This is not American with Disabilities Act because American with Disabilities Act is more if you have a life altering type of disability such as epilepsy, or you have if you're in a wheelchair, something that affects one or more of your major life functions, and a temporary broken leg does not rise to that level. So the answer to the question is your employer does not have to give you time off. The employer does not have to accommodate you in any way and can actually fire you if you can't come to work and do the job. So what I would do, obviously, from a practical standpoint, if you're a good employer, employee, and you've been, and this guy's a good employer, you might just say to them, what can we do here? I'd like to keep my job. I'd like you to keep the job open for me. Is there an opportunity for me to do a desk job? Or can you just guarantee me that when I'm better to come back, that you can give me a job? And see if you can do it from a standpoint of agreement and hopefully the employer will accommodate you. But there's no legal obligation in that regard. The workplace is really not a very good place for the employee. There's some good laws that protect you in certain places, but they're not required to be fair. There is a texter from last week on the show that said, my daughter had a baby at age 18. She did not tell the father that she was pregnant. We are taking care of our grandson. Do we have any obligation to advise the father that he has a son? The young man is immature, irresponsible, and my daughter wants nothing to do with him. Okay, so you're a grandparent. Your child had a baby at a young age, and the father doesn't know. And the grandparents are wanting to know, do I have to tell the father? Well, I don't see that there's any legal obligation for the grandparent to call up the father and say, guess what, you have a child. From a moral standpoint, it makes sense that you would do that. And here's why I say this. Even though the child is young and you've got an immature man who is not going to be in a situation to be a very responsible father, I have found that even young men will step up to the plate when they know they have a child. And it's really unfair to the child for that child not to know their father and not to have a good relationship. And the other issue is child support. Certainly, if that young man is employed, he will have to pay some money to help support the child. It just makes sense that you want to encourage a child to have a relationship with both parents. If you listen to earlier the interview that we did with Dr. David Finn, it's very important that even if the father may not be ready to be a dad, may be immature, as long as he's not harmful to the child, it really is important for that child to get to know the father, even when the child is an infant. And some protections can be put into place. The father can have rights to come and visit the child for short periods of time until the child's old enough. And a lot of, like I said, young men and women, you know, it's not just men, but young men will grow into the job and will step up to the plate. And maybe even he has grandparents who would like to get to know this child and who can help with the child care responsibilities. Because raising a child on your own and being a grandparent raising a child is a very difficult thing to do. And you need all the help you can get. Give us a call here, 591-7200. We're kind of ending the calls here, but let's see. We've got Dick. Welcome to WGN. Hi, Dick.
Hi, counselor. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm a former Chicagoan. I live up here in Wisconsin. But there was, and I'm really curious because I've not heard anything about this. There was a case, I want to say about a year ago, a police officer shot a suspect. And they were charged with first-degree murder. And I don't know, can't remember anything being resolved with that. Did they plea bargain, or do you remember the case?
There have been several of them where the police officer was charged with first-degree murder. And there was one that just went to trial a little while ago. You don't mean the Laquan McDonald murder.
I don't remember.
I slipped when I said that, the shooting, where he shot him like 16 times, right? That wasn't the one.
That might be the one.
Okay, no, that has not gone to trial yet, and that has gone through a lot of legal machinations. And that probably would be going to trial, I would think, in the next 4 or 5 months. But that there was another case that came down that was similar. But, you know, if you have more facts, let me know, and I can look it up for you. Is it, you know, and you don't know where it was or what part of the city it was?
No, I don't remember.
Okay.
But I would, I mean, a cynical person like myself, I would think first-degree murder would probably be over the top, maybe manslaughter, but I would suspect it would be hard to prove first-degree murder, and I expect the police officer will probably walk because of that.
That's a good point. When there's overcharging by the prosecutor's office, there's a likelihood that perhaps the jury is going to react poorly to that. And, you know, first-degree murder, you have to show that you had an intent to harm somebody, and there's no self-defense, and there's no reasonable belief that someone was going to harm you. I mean, it is a very difficult thing to be a police officer. It's very difficult when you've got your life on the line and someone is pulling a gun, or even you think they're pulling a gun, but you're right. A first-degree murder charge is very difficult when it comes to police officers, and I would guess that if you Google that statistic, you're going to find in this whole country that there are probably just a handful of convictions for first-degree murder in a case like that. But thank you for the call, and if you want to email me, I'll see what I can find, okay?
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. Have a good night. Let's just wrap up here. Again, I'm going to give out my number at the office, 312-332-7800, or give me a quick email with your name and where you're from and what it is you're looking for, and that's WGN@AskKarenConti.com. A couple of stories I'm just going to finish up with that are kind of interesting. This is a case in San Francisco. A doctor named Dr. James Lila was a physician, and he was being sued for medical malpractice. In the middle of the trial just gets underway, one of the jurors falls over. And, of course, the doctor, he's the doctor in the house, he runs over and administers CPR and uses an external defibrillator. The guy, I don't know exactly what happened to him down the line, but he still had a pulse and the ambulance took him away. What a story, huh? And then, of course, the plaintiff's lawyer asked for a mistrial because the plaintiff said, well, listen, you know, if this guy's a hero with the jurors, of course the jurors are going to reward him and find him not responsible for whatever malpractice he was accused of. So that did in fact happen, and the judge dismissed the jury and picked a new one. Very interesting story. And another one that I saw, the New York legislature passed a law yesterday, which is strange, on a Saturday, passed a law requiring those convicted of domestic violence to surrender their handguns, not only their handguns, but their long guns as well. New York has some of the strongest gun laws in the country, and they've had a real reduction in gun crime, and in particular in murders. And what's really interesting is that this raises a constitutional question. The Supreme Court has ruled on a case very similar to this, saying that, yeah, the law can take away your gun rights if you have domestic violence convictions. But I think there are a lot of people out there who are in favor of this and say that, yeah, we have a lot of the shooters that you've seen in Las Vegas, the Pulse shooter down in Florida. A lot of those people have had domestic violence issues, harassing, disparaging women. So maybe these are the people that we do need to take guns away from. Again, that's a slippery slope because, as you know, people can make allegations about anything, and I'm sure that the gun rights people are going to be wildly against this new law. It's been nice talking to you all. Happy Easter, happy Passover, happy April Fool's Day. I'm glad Brian Noonan is still employed and still has a show, because we thought for a while that he wasn't. Have a great week. You're listening to Karen Conti on WGN.